anesthesia enthusiasts, and welcome to another episode of Style Points. Today, Nate Moore is joining us to present his final RSI, as he is no longer a resident as of this recording. Fortunately, however, he is joining the University of Cincinnati as a faculty member and will continue to help me with the podcast. Now he's going to talk to us about liver disease classification. Nate, take it away.
When I first saw the word MASH, M-A-S-H, in a patient's chart, I assumed it was either a funny misspelling of NASH, as in non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, or an oblique reference to an 80s sitcom. When I saw it a few more times, I did some digging and realized that a whole new diagnosis had been invented that I didn't know about. Is this what getting old feels like? To save you the embarrassment that I felt, and to help you make the right clinical decisions for a patient with a strange new diagnosis in their chart, I'll tell you what I learned about the new terminology for steatotic liver disease. First, what is it that we're trying to classify? The core pathophysiologic mechanism that we're trying to describe with all these definitions is steatosis, which refers to the accumulation of excess fat within the liver. This excess fat causes hepatic injury via multiple incompletely understood mechanisms, but the end result is an increased production of scar tissue within the liver, leading to decreased liver function and ultimately cirrhosis. Traditionally, the term for liver disease related to steatosis has been fatty liver disease. The association of alcohol use with the development of fatty liver disease has several medical and societal implications. Thus, fatty liver disease has traditionally been divided into alcohol-related liver disease and non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. However, there are several potential problems with this terminology. While this binary definition, alcohol versus no alcohol, is simple, it doesn't always do a good job of capturing the complex range of conditions that can lead to hepatic steatosis, particularly in terms of describing how varying quantities of alcohol use can contribute to liver disease in the setting of hepatic steatosis. Furthermore, the use of the terms alcoholic and fatty can be considered stigmatizing, which can negatively affect patients' interactions with healthcare systems, whether they choose to interact with healthcare systems at all, and affect their ability to discuss their conditions with their friends and family members. To improve how we talk about liver disease, the American Association for the Study of Liver Diseases, the AASLD, has proposed a single overarching term for fatty liver disease, which is steatotic liver disease, or SLD. Steatotic liver disease is then divided into several subcategories. The first is metabolic dysfunction-associated steatotic liver disease, or MASLD. This is most easily linked to non-alcoholic fatty liver disease in the previous terminology and describes the state in which cardiometabolic risk factors, such as obesity or diabetes, are the definite drivers of a patient's hepatic steatosis. On the other end of the spectrum is alcohol-associated liver disease, or ALD, which closely mirrors the previous alcohol-related liver disease and identifies the use of alcohol as the definite driver of a patient's liver disease. In between ALD and MASLD lies metabolic and alcohol-related liver disease, or MET-ALD. MET-ALD is intended to describe how various quantities of consistent alcohol use can occur in the presence of cardiometabolic risk factors and is therefore divided into MASLD predominant MET-ALD and ALD predominant MET-ALD. The AASLD has created a set of diagnostic criteria to help decide where a patient falls within this classification. Once a patient is known to have steatotic liver disease, usually diagnosed by imaging findings or a biopsy, it is then determined whether they fulfill at least one out of five cardiometabolic criteria. There are some exceptions, but the major criteria include a BMI greater than or equal to 25, an A1C level greater than or equal to 5.7%, a blood pressure greater than or equal to 130 over 85, triglycerides over 1.7, or an HDL less than or equal to 1 in males or 1.3 in females. If a patient fulfills at least one of these criteria and has no other known causes of steatosis, they are diagnosed as having MASLD, metabolic dysfunction-associated steatotic liver disease. If they fulfill none of these cardiometabolic criteria, then they'll receive a diagnosis specific to their type of liver disease. This will frequently be related to alcohol use and thus termed ALD, alcohol-associated liver disease. If a patient fulfills at least one of the cardiometabolic criteria, but also consumes a significant quantity of alcohol, they are diagnosed as having MET-ALD, metabolic and alcohol-related liver disease. They then receive a diagnosis based on the quantity of their alcohol use. If the predominant driver of the patient's liver disease is considered to be alcohol use, they receive a diagnosis of ALD predominant MET-ALD. If the predominant driver is instead considered to be the patient's cardiometabolic risk factors, the diagnosis MASLD predominant MET-ALD is used instead. There are no specific threshold quantities of alcohol use recommended by the AASLD to make this determination, but they state that the predominant driver within MET-ALD can change over time for a specific individual. These classifications, MASLD, ALD, and MET-ALD, are the predominant categories under the SLD umbrella. There are two more classifications, specific etiology SLD, which covers some more zebra diagnoses, and cryptogenic SLD, the fancy way of saying we don't know why someone has liver disease, but the specifics of those lie outside the scope of this segment. What's important is that you now know the new SLD terminology and can confidently pre-op your next patient with liver disease.
Thanks, Nate. Corey Martidum is a certified registered nurse anesthetist who works with me here at the University of Cincinnati. She obtained her BSN in nursing here at the University of Cincinnati, her master's in sciences in nursing at Rush University, and her DNP at Johns Hopkins in 2023. She packs her lunch in a bento box every day and enjoys wearing colorful scrub caps. Corey, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So I wanted to start off with one of my standard get-to-know-you questions to start us off. If you could have dinner with anyone in the world, now this could be somebody from the past or from fiction or anything, who would you have dinner with and why?
My mind goes totally blank when you ask that question. But it's not for a lack of amazing people in this world. It's just real hard to choose. So, let's see. Okay. We are here in the middle of July, and we're well accustomed now to this summer heat, and dinner looks like barbecue in the backyard.
Sounds good to me.
My sister and her husband bring over two bottles of wine and a crate of peaches and the kids. And my friend already has like 16 giant zucchini squash handpicked from their garden that they don't know what to do with. And the neighbors come over with all their kids and potato salad, and dinner is joyful chaos and a sheet cake topped with blueberries at the end. And my guest arrives as the kids are splashing around in the inflatable pool, and the grown-ups are thinking about getting everyone home and off to bed soon.
Mm-hmm.
But he's not late to the party at all. He's just in time to catch everyone in that loose moment between finishing and leaving. And it's Neil Young.
Neil Young. Excellent. Is he going to be performing for you or what?
Yep. He shows up with his guitar and a harmonica, and he sits in a chair on the back patio and plays Harvest Moon with the fan turning slowly above his head. And my brother-in-law asks my sister to dance, and there's the way she smiles at him, which is maybe a little too rare amidst the context of running a house and being a nurse and raising two kids. But tonight, we all get to fall in love a little bit again.
Well, that is a lovely picture that you've painted for us. I can very much imagine that. As long as there aren't too many mosquitoes out, that sounds like an ideal sort of backyard fun time.
Yeah, for sure.
So let's dive in a little bit more to talk about what we wanted to talk about today. You wanted to talk about using propofol as a main anesthetic agent as opposed to using gas. Can you tell me a little bit more about why that's a big deal, not just for the environment, but for our patients too? Tell me more.
I'd be happy to. Using propofol as the primary anesthetic agent is a big deal for patients because of many reasons we already are familiar with, like preventing nausea, it doesn't interrupt signal transmission during interoperative for neuromonitoring. And in my experience, there's not the same kind of stage two as with volatile anesthetics.
Mm-hmm.
So extubating on propofol usually means less coughing, bucking, salivating. It's just a smoother process. So if there's any concern about abdominal surgery or surgery to the neck or throat or face that you don't want to disrupt, propofol can smooth that out.
Well, I think a lot of us do propofol wake-ups where we're And I did one yesterday, actually, where we turned off the gas a little bit early and then transitioned to propofol as we were waking up. That's a common technique that we all like to use, but you're advocating for using propofol for the whole thing. Is that right?
No gas, really,
So
from the get-go.
what's so bad about the gas?
Well, there's a big focus on global warming right now. We're really starting to see a lot of the negative impacts of rising global temperatures. News agencies like the BBC are headlining our warming world as directly tied to atypical events like Hurricane Beryl making landfall earlier in the season than any other Category 5 hurricane in the last 100 years.
Sure.
So people are taking climate change seriously. And so we're starting to look at ways where our anesthesia practice contributes to that. And one of the first areas that was identified is the use of fluorinated gases, which are our main anesthetic agents, the volatiles.
So those contribute to global warming.
Yes, they do. So we have news from the National Academy of Medicine. It acknowledges that the US healthcare sector accounts for about 8.5% of US carbon emissions, with hospital care accounting for about a third of that. So admittedly, anesthesia providers are not going to turn the tide on climate change, even if we all acted in concert over what is about less than 3% of US emissions, which is not even global emissions. But in 2010, the American Society of Anesthesiologists started taking this issue seriously to the point that they authored a document on environmental sustainability in anesthesia practice, by that title. The 2023 updates state that life cycle greenhouse emissions from inhaled anesthetics are several orders of magnitude greater than for that of propofol. And their number one strategy for mitigating the effects of inhaled anesthetics is to avoid their use in favor of intravenous and regional techniques.
So why don't we currently just use propofol for all of our anesthetics? Maybe you could describe for some of our student listeners why we don't use propofol for everything all the time anyway.
Well, in theory, you could. I think there's a long-standing history, especially as a student, of just being trained on all the tools in the
Sure.
box, which is absolutely appropriate. There's a cost difference for sure. We can get into that in finer detail, but
Sure.
a propofol anesthetic is one of the more costly ones. And the gases just came onto the market prior. I think going back to the late 1800s, nitrous oxide was isolated, and then the fluorinated agents came around in the 70s and early 80s. I don't know exactly when propofol was synthesized, but the others and the technique of using an inhaled, like even going back to chloroform or ether, those things are breathed. So I think that's just been sort of the custom of anesthesia. And we haven't yet really found a good reason to move away from it, especially given the cost. So I don't know, here we are at a moment of considering, like, is it worth it to do so?
Well, there's different kinds of costs, I guess.
Sure.
We have the cost to the hospital is the cost that I think a lot of people think of, and it's more expensive to run to Teva. That's sometimes a hard pill to swallow. But over time, there's the cost to the backyard barbecue, right?
Of course. Yeah.
And that's really what we're working to try to preserve is our ability to hang out in the backyard, maybe not with Neil Young, but just generally speaking, right?
Yeah.
So it makes sense to try to preserve that for our kids and for our kids' kids, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And there are lots of aspects to consider, like the life cycle analysis of any drug, which includes the packaging and how it's produced and how it's transported. So it's not just the global warming potential of the liquid itself that you're either turning into a gas or delivering directly intravenously. There's a bigger picture that surrounds it for sure. And the ASA has taken that into consideration in their recommendations.
So is the ASA pushing for more propofol-based anesthetics then?
They are. Yep. That was their top two strategies, are to use intravenous anesthetics wherever possible, and regional, I think, actually is truly the way forward, the best bang for the buck in terms of patient and environment. So we can discuss that further too. But yeah, there's definitely a trend away from volatile anesthetics. I just don't think that information is really making headlines in the clinical setting. I first heard about it at a conference in Portland, maybe 5 years ago. I saw a PowerPoint by anesthesiologist Dr. Cheesebro, who practices in Oregon. He quoted the Lorax. It was...
That's fantastic.
I know. It was like meticulously done research and also a lot of heart.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
So you mentioned atmospheric lifetime of anesthetics. Can you tell me a little bit more about what that means?
Sure. Okay. So before we address that explicitly, let's go back a little bit and talk about global warming potential.
Sure.
And then subsets thereof. So all anesthetic gases have a global warming potential because they're greenhouse gases. And those specifically are the gases isoflurane, DES, SIBO, and then nitrous. So the EPA recognizes greenhouse gases as those that trap heat energy within the Earth's atmosphere rather than allowing it to diffuse into space.
Okay.
Fluorinated gases are typically produced in smaller quantities than other greenhouse gases, but they're particularly potent and have orders of magnitude more global warming potential than, for example, carbon dioxide.
Oh, okay.
But global warming potential is a means of standardizing the environmental impact of greenhouse gases despite their unique properties so that they can be compared. So global warming potential is measured in CO2 equivalents, which considers a greenhouse gas's radiative efficacy, which is the heat insulation value of the gas, okay, and the lifetime in the atmosphere. So its duration measured out to about 100 years. So when we talk about the environmental impact of greenhouse gas of any kind, we use metric tons of CO2, even if the gas is nitrous or sibofluorine, and it contains those two components of heat insulation and duration in the atmosphere.
Okay. So what are we talking? How bad are our halogenated agents?
Well, isoflurane has an atmospheric lifetime of 1.2 years.
Is that a long time?
Comparatively, no, actually. Sibofluorine lasts 3 years.
Okay.
DES fluorine lasts 10.
Oh, okay.
So the decade-long atmospheric lifetime of DES fluorine, being 3 to 6 times that of ISO or SIBO, has garnered a lot of negative attention and has actually prompted the phase out of many hospitals in the last few years.
Yeah, our institution stopped using DES fluorine a while ago, actually.
Yeah, same with the hospital that I was working at before I came here. I remember actually conversations around it being phased out and whether or not we wanted to keep like a vaporizer or two of it for special cases. And we did for a while. And I'm not sure if that was the case now that it's gone or if it's still there. But yeah, for the most part, it's been removed.
That makes sense. Do you feel like the reason it was removed was from an environmental standpoint or from a hospital cost basis standpoint or a mixture of both?
Do you know the cost comparison? Is DES more expensive?
Well, I think it depends on the rate of flow. I went to a DES fluorine dinner once when I was a resident, and they were trying to sell our hospital DES fluorine.
Okay.
And I went because I was very poor at the time, mm-hmm, and a free steak dinner sounded like a good option for me.
Yeah, right on.
And so I remember them talking about DES fluorine being cheaper as long as you turn the flows way, way, way down. But I think in general, it's more expensive.
Okay. Well, I don't know about the cost specifically. I asked our pharmacy here for mm-hmm some like literal digit value costs mm-hmm on drugs, which we can get into in a little bit, but I did not ask about DES fluorine specifically because we haven't been using it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But I know there are some other side effects regarding, you know, respiratory issues with wake up and...
Right. People tend to cough a lot more from it.
Yeah. It's great for a quicker onset offset, or at least that's, you know, my familiarity with it was using it for bariatric surgeries.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed to be that was the last room where the vaporizer was kept when we were in the process of phasing it out. So yeah,
that makes sense.
Yeah, but even there now, I think it's pretty much gone because any skilled anesthesia provider can titrate your gas down at the end of the case for a timely wake up.
Just turn up your flows.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's talk about the different costs that you were mentioning then. What are some of the different costs of the different medicines that you were able to find?
So here's a simple cost comparison in dollars among a handful of our common anesthetic agents.
Okay.
Propofol costs about $1 per milliliter. The small 20 milliliter bottle is $20. The big 100 ml bottle is about $100. A 250 ml bottle of SIBO costs about $385.
Hmm.
A 30 milliliter bottle of 0.25% bupivacaine is $13.20. And the 2 milliliter bottle of 0.75 heavy marcaine used for spinals is $9.30.
Wow.
Yeah.
Our regional team would be thrilled to make this point for us.
One of my professors in grad school had this great quote, needle in the back is best.
Mm.
I think it's hasn't been challenged yet, at least not by these numbers. So if we had $10 to spend on an anesthetic, let's see how far we could get with regional versus propofol versus a volatile technique. Because it can be a little complex to get your head around all this without a pen and paper in front of you. And so if you're listening in the car, we'll make it a little more graspable. So let's start with the most direct drugs.
Okay.
The bupivacaine and the marcaine. These drugs are super cheap, on the order of roughly $10 to do a spinal that lasts a solid 2 hours or a regional block that could last 8 to 12 hours. $10 for that. Plus the cost of needles and maybe an ultrasound for the block. Propofol is a little harder to quantify, but here's an easy way to think about it. We often work with propofol in micrograms. It's a standard 1% solution. So it's always 10,000 mics per 1 ml of propofol. And we can work with a 100 kilo patient just for easy math. If we run a 100 kilo patient at 100 mics per kg per minute, we're using 10,000 mics per minute. So we're using 1 ml. Per minute.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a cost of $1 per minute.
Okay, that's pretty easy.
So if we have that same $10 to spend as we did for our regional patient, we get 10 minutes of propofol anesthesia for the same price.
Gotcha.
Doesn't go nearly as far.
That's true.
Yeah. Volatile anesthetics are easy enough to quantify in dollars, but the math will take you back to your freshman chem notes on Avogadro's number. So let's just look at the results of some research here.
Okay.
In observational retrospective studies by French researchers published earlier this year in Anesthesia, which is the journal of the ASA, the Association of Anesthetists, and that's comparable to the ASA here, but it's the Association of Practitioners in Great Britain and Ireland.
Okay.
They compared the cost of TEVA with a mixed TEVA plus gas anesthetic. The approach was over roughly 47,000 anesthetics, 25,000 TEVA and 22,000 TEVA plus gas. The mean length of each case was about 2 hours, and the cost in US dollars for the TEVA plus volatile anesthetic approach was 61 cents.
Oh, okay.
So that's incorporating gas into the mix, compared to $12.38 for a pure TEVA strategy. These costs are for the whole case, roughly 2 hours. So going back to having $10 to spend on an anesthetic, you could more or less buy a TEVA plus gas approach that would cover the whole case for $10. And this study reports that the carbon footprint for the TEVA only strategy is 20 times less than that of the TEVA plus the volatile.
Hmm. So it seems like from an environmental standpoint, it might make sense over time to approach the legislature with some concepts about how we could maybe be subsidized or something like that.
Yeah, gas is so cheap, but there's a huge savings in carbon emissions for TEVA at a higher cost in dollars. So it's really a matter of what feels most worth it.
Right. That makes sense. So desflurane isn't the only anesthetic that's being phased out. We're also sort of working to phase nitrous oxide out. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how has that been taking effect in hospitals across the United States? The idea of getting rid of desflurane and nitrous oxide, what does that look like?
Well, I'm not sure how it filters down through leadership, like where the idea gets planted that mm-hmm. eventually results in a change, like in the OR. But it seems like the general strategy is that because the overall contribution of anesthesia to the problem of global warming is pretty small, it's not like we need to get rid of these drugs 100% entirely, wash our hands of them, and never look back. It's like we recognize the cases where nitrous oxide, for example, is actually the best thing we can do. Like maybe for labor analgesia, you can take a couple breaths of the gas. It's totally patient controlled. There's very little risk to mom and baby. And it's the only drug that has that property, really. You can't just bolus a pregnant woman with 20 milligrams of propofol and wait for it to wear off while she has a contraction. Like, that's not really a wise move.
Less than ideal.
Yeah. So there are special use cases where nitrous oxide is actually the best thing for the job.
I think our friends at Children's would also probably reflect if we removed nitrous from their material.
Right. So because it's not a make or break, you know, we're not utilizing tons and tons of concrete or some other CO2 heavy industry. We're using a tank of nitrous. It makes perfect sense to keep it for these ideal cases and to phase it out of standard everyday practice, like a general anesthetic for an appendectomy. We don't really need it. We used it kind of like water when I was in school mm-hmm. 11 years ago. But in light of the fact that it has environmental repercussions that are pretty significant, and that there are really alternatives that don't compromise the practice in any meaningful way, at least in my book. Maybe some people got really attached to it and they're sad to see it go, but it hasn't really been a part of my practice since I learned how to use it. So
it's changed in both of our practices at different institutions, but what about overall in the United States, or maybe worldwide? How have emissions from anesthetic gases changed over the years?
So here's a snapshot of how things have unfolded since about 1990 and where we are now. The US EPA keeps an inventory of greenhouse gas emissions and sinks. It's a report that contains a chart on fluorinated gas emissions from 1990 to 2022. It's a simple line graph, and it shows how fluorinated gas emissions peaked in the US in the late 1990s, and then declined significantly over the next 3 years, reaching a low in 2002. Since that nadir, fluorinated gas emissions have risen steadily to surpass late 90s levels, and the upward trajectory continues through 2022. I don't have more recent data than that, but as of 2022, we were not gaining ground, and we had been losing it steadily for nearly two decades. So the phase out of the most impactful greenhouse gases is one of anesthesia leadership's moves to lessen the environmental impact of our practice within this metric of fluorinated gas emissions.
So not all of us are in the room when these policies are being made, or not necessarily in the position to eliminate these things from our hospitals. What can we do as individual anesthesia providers or as OR managers to help reduce the environmental impact of anesthesia?
Sure. There are plenty of things that pass directly through our hands that we can control every case we do. Certainly increasing awareness among stakeholders. So all of us who practice anesthesia, OR managers, hospital administrators, raising awareness on the harmful environmental effects of certain anesthetics and providing knowledge about environmentally friendly alternatives is probably the first step. But in terms of specific suggestions, the American Society of Anesthesiologists suggests these ways to reduce inhaled anesthetic atmospheric waste. Number one, use low flows, which I think we're all pretty familiar with that. But what exactly does low flow mean to you? I can dial things down to maybe like 0.8 liters per minute without the vent alarming that there's not enough gas moving through the system, or compromising the patient's oxygenation. I don't know. They don't set a particular threshold for low flow.
Well, Alex Topala in our department did a grand rounds a while back. I think it was before you joined us.
Okay.
About using low flow sevoflurane as more standard practice, not just to save, not just because of the environmental impact, but also to save our department money.
Sure.
The standard I think that a lot of people were doing here was 1 liter per minute of oxygen and 1 liter per minute of air, just in the background, because those are nice round numbers. And yeah, we as humans enjoy seeing nice round numbers. I have seen
very satisfying.
Yeah, I've seen anesthesia providers on the machines with 2 decimal points spend a lot of time making it 1.00, as we're all sort of control freaks in anesthesia. But what Alex's point was, and I agree with him, is that's probably too much, especially if you're in a long case.
Yeah,
you can just turn down those flows. And what he advocated for, and what our theoretical department standard, although nobody's going around policing this, is we turn everything down to 0.5 of air and 0.5 of oxygen.
Okay.
Just as a way to cut down on the amount of SIVO that we're using.
Sure. So 1 liter total.
1 liter flows.
Perfect.
That's just nice. Sort of as a
round number too.
Yeah, there we go. It can still satisfy that one. Innate urge that we have. Make it one.
Fantastic. Okay. So recommendation one, utilize low fresh gas flows. The second recommendation is to avoid high impact inhaled anesthetics, so DES and nitrous. And okay, I think we're kind of already on board with the phase out of those things. Consider intravenous and regional techniques. Certainly, if that's what we've been talking about for a few minutes here, I feel like my observation of the bigger picture of anesthetic planning here includes quite a lot of regional anesthesia.
Mm-hmm.
Various techniques for blocking parts of the trunk, various limbs, and then of course like spinals and epidurals when appropriate. So like I mentioned earlier, I think the regional techniques are the cost-wise least effective. And for the patient, often provide some post-op analgesia as well. So there's a fair amount of stretch that you get with that beyond the operating room itself.
So propofol has some advantages and disadvantages when compared to the gases. The biggest disadvantage that normally comes to my mind when I'm thinking about propofol is the risk of intraoperative awareness.
Mm.
I wonder if you could speak a little bit on the risk of that, just generally, and then what our approach can be to mitigate that. And then we can talk about some of the advantages of propofol.
Sure. Well, I was taught and have practiced for a decade with volatiles, assuming that 0.8% exhaled sevoflurane
mm-hmm.
is the threshold for awareness. So if you're running your anesthetic higher than 0.8, the risk of awareness is very low.
Vanishingly small.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially if you've given like a benzodiazepine like Versed prior mm-hmm. to the start of the case. I don't know of a specific metric like that for propofol.
Well, the risk is slightly higher with propofol, of course, but it's just something that we can keep in mind and again try to mitigate with some of those same strategies, right?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think the most probably reassuring would be to put on a BIS monitor.
Mm-hmm.
That gives you at least a number that you can watch drift. But I've run propofol without a BIS for most of my career and have just watched vital signs. And if I'm running somebody at about 100 mics per kilo per minute and their blood pressure and heart rate are aligned with their baseline for comfort, and I've given additional agents like some sort of narcotic, benzodiazepine, maybe some Presidex, I've felt pretty confident in that.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think as long as you keep in mind, just in general, that it has a slightly higher risk of awareness, and you need to do things to mitigate that, especially in patients that have a higher MAC value at baseline. Maybe they're 21 years old and they smoke a lot of weed or something like that.
Yeah, and it depends. Did they smoke that day or not? Because one way our job is easier and one way it's harder.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's true.
But no, titrating in something like ketamine can be really helpful too, especially if you pre-medicate with Versed. Although ketamine doesn't necessarily require a benzodiazepine to prevent delirium.
That's true.
Depending on the dose, but there are therapeutic things happening in ketamine clinics without benzo pre-meds that are pretty promising. So I don't know, maybe we're helping out mental health situations there too.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so that's probably the main disadvantage that I think of, but what are some of the advantages of using propofol over the inhaled anesthetics?
Propofol is a very short-acting IV anesthetic that undergoes rapid hepatic metabolism and renal elimination. So only a small fraction of the drug is metabolized via extrahepatic routes, which means the environmental impact is minimal. But in terms of patient physiology and safety, propofol's hepatic metabolism plays a key role in emergence, especially if you're looking to extubate the patient deep or to avoid emerging through stage two, as with a volatile anesthetic. In my experience, propofol wake-ups don't involve near as much Goodell manifestations of tearing, salivating, delirium. And once the tube is out, any remaining propofol continues to clear the body with little dependence on ventilation. With a volatile anesthetic, you get to a particular expiratory concentration where you can pull the tube, whether that be deep or fully emerged. But the patient literally has to breathe off any remaining volatile. So there's a greater risk of hypoventilation, slowing the volatile agent clearance, and potentially prolonging wake up, or maybe even putting the patient back to sleep, depending upon how hypopneic they are. You know, we can watch what we're doing and safely wake up a patient from a volatile anesthetic just as well as a propofol anesthetic or an anesthetic combined from any other drugs. It's not that a volatile anesthetic wake up is inherently some kind of risk, but I do think propofol offers an advantage at wake up because the metabolic pathway allows the anesthesia provider a fairly predictable continued regression of anesthesia because it's not ventilation dependent.
So yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Need to give more opiates in PACU and you used a volatile anesthetic and they hypoventilate, there's maybe more of a risk of sleepiness. Whereas with propofol, the body is just going to continue to metabolize it and they can hold their breath and it will still be gone.
Hopefully they don't.
No, we don't want that. But, you know, theoretically, it would clear at the same rate regardless of ventilation.
So I think what most of us are used to using propofol in is neurosurgery. Tell us more about why we tend to use propofol during neurosurgery.
So I've got a bunch of research here. Actually, it's one study really, but we'll put that in the
show notes. Sure. Yeah.
Great. So propofol is better for clear-headed awakening and preventing nausea and vomiting. Propofol helps relax the brain and lowers pressure inside the skull. It reduces the brain's oxygen use and decreases blood flow, unlike inhalation anesthetics. So it doesn't significantly alter cerebral autoregulation.
That makes sense. So I can already imagine somebody thinking about changing their anesthetic plan to incorporate Ativa, and they're thinking to themselves about all of the plastic that they're using as they unpack all the syringes and all of the pump tubing and everything else that goes along with it. So is it really that much more environmentally beneficial despite all of the extra plastic that we're generating?
That's a really hard call to make and a really important point. Propofol, yeah, undeniably uses a lot of plastic tubing to deliver the drugs via IV. And when the plastics break down, they do so into particles so small that they can be inhaled or ingested. And tissue translocation is the big issue with particles that small, because if they can cross biological barriers like the lungs and the intestines, they can become lodged in human tissues and have potential impacts like oxidative stress and inflammation, which can disrupt the normal function of numerous body systems. So in March of this year, the Mayo Clinic Individualized Medicine website headlined research published by the New England Journal of Medicine on the presence of micro and nanoplastics in human blood vessel plaques and speculated at a link to increased risks of stroke, heart attack, and death. So we're going to do great with greenhouse gases and global warming, but then we're all going to just be made of plastic at the end of the day. Yeah, all the tubing matters. And at UC, we have two choices regarding the pumps we use to deliver propofol. One pump uses tubing and plastic chambers that require 20 milliliters of liquid just to prime it, and the other requires that the propofol be drawn out of a glass bottle into a 60 ml syringe, but involves far less tubing. So which of those is the better choice? I'm not sure that there's a way to quantify that, at least not without a lot of like modeling and math and life cycle analysis. That's maybe a heavier lift than what we want to do right now.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah, but the point is there that nothing is without risk and nothing is the clear advantage. Like maybe we do reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but what we contribute to plastic wastes and the environmental impact there is potentially just as considerable.
So in a lot of these procedures that we're doing, we generate a decent amount of propofol waste. I'm thinking of all the times that I've drawn up a second stick of propofol and ended up not using it. What tips do you have for minimizing the propofol waste that we have during our procedures?
Yeah, I mean, it's nice to look at the screen on the ventilator and see, or on your monitor and see what your end tidal SIVO to it. It's nice to be able to look at the screen on the monitor and see what your end tidal SIVO or DES or nitrous or whatever exhales.
That's true.
You're using is because it gives you a benchmark for how much you need. And we know if we watch patient responsiveness, we can titrate the mics per kick per minute, but we don't quite know how much to put in the syringe. So there's simple math. Anytime you're running 10,000 mics per kilo per minute, you're running 1 mL per minute. So that's a 100 kilo patient at 100 mics per kilo per minute.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a smaller patient, about 70 kilos, and you're running them at approximately 75 mics per kilo per minute, that's 5,000. So half of that. And we talked earlier about anytime you're getting to 10,000 mics per kilo per minute, that's 1 mL per minute. So if you're drawing up a bottle of 20, that's a 20-minute bottle for a 100 kilo patient at 100 mics per kilo per minute. If you're taking that same 20 ml bottle and running it at 75 for a 70 kilo patient, then it's going to last twice as long. So that's a 40-minute bottle.
So how do we predict how much time the surgeon is going to take?
This is where you get your magic eight ball and you start shaking and then you just wait for the little triangle to float to the top that says ask again later.
So zooming out, let's talk about making anesthesia more environmentally friendly. What trends do you see happening? Where do you see things going in the future?
Yeah. So there was kind of an interesting story that I heard about on NPR the other day. In terms of using regional techniques,
mm-hmm.
even without propofol, this case in particular, at least as far as I can understand the details, the patient was responsive to name throughout the whole case, and maybe got some sedation, Versed, fentanyl, ketamine, something maybe, but was able to respond to name at major points during the surgery. So the story is that in June of 2024, the surgeons at Northwestern Medicine in Chicago performed the first known awake kidney transplant. Awake.
Wow.
In the United States on a 28-year-old named John Nicholas. Nicholas received a spinal and some light sedation. ABC7 Chicago reported that the patient was responsive to name during the surgery and happy to receive updates on milestones throughout the process. They also report that Northwestern Medicine is looking into establishing an AWAKE program, or accelerated surgery without general anesthesia, in kidney transplants for patients who want the option, and hope to limit the admission to a 24-hour stay.
Hmm.
This is totally outstanding, and in many ways, an ideal case to substitute for GA. But this is a great moment to champion regional anesthesia of all kinds, also, not just neuraxial, infusion catheters, single-shot blocks, field blocks, yes, any of it. Anytime you can numb the surgical area, there's so much potential to reduce, if not eliminate, the need for other kinds of anesthesia. You can easily cut the MAC of an inhaled anesthetic by half by using an interscalene infusion catheter for a total shoulder and provide 3 days of post-op analgesia all in one go. So I think regional is the way forward, especially with the cost comparison that we did earlier in dollars. Regional anesthetics, the little bottle of local anesthetic is far less expensive than any of the other options. Except maybe gas. That 61 cents is hard to beat.
So I think you've provided us with an excellent overview of all the things that we can do to keep anesthesia more environmentally friendly. Using propofol is probably better than using the gases in general, and there's some better side effect profiles that go along with that. Regional is maybe the most cost-effective thing that we can do. And then I think we just have to keep in mind the amount of plastics that we're using when we're unpacking everything. I think these are all awesome points. So let's talk about what style points have brought you success in your career in and out of the operating room. Can you give us some of your ideas for how you like to run things?
Sure. I think it's just an ongoing questioning of often just the small ways where I can do something a little better. I went on a medical mission trip to Bolivia in 2014, and we had, I don't know, like 3 syringes per patient. And this was a year after I graduated from my master's degree. And we were basically told that syringes are single use. And I think for a lot of people, that's the case. But we were in an environment where resources were limited. And to reuse a syringe, if you think about it, is actually a fine thing to do. If you're worried about drug cross-contamination, maybe, I don't even know what 2 drugs would precipitate, but just for example, if you gave fentanyl and that's all finished, and then you need to give Zofran at the end of the case, you do have to be conscious about your labeling. It's important not to get yourself mixed up, but you could take that same 3cc or 5cc syringe. You could flush it with the IV tubing that you're using to give the patient all of the drugs anyway, and then draw up a single vial of Zofran and give that. So you just saved yourself a 3cc syringe worth of plastic that's ultimately going to go in the landfill. I mean, if we all did that once a day, every day, the pile would be huge. So that's something. But here we are talking too. I don't know, we met just a couple months ago,
mm-hmm.
and a conversation led us to this opportunity to have a bigger conversation that more people can hear, so we can share ideas. And it makes me think, I wonder if our NSAs are getting this information. I wonder if they're going to listen to this podcast, because they're the ones who are in the role right now of like developing their techniques, figuring out their ways. So maybe this will loop back to students out there who are considering how they want to best do their job. So just finding all the different ways that opportunities arise and connect and grow.
Thank you so much for joining us. I really enjoyed having you on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
Thanks again for joining us today. If you have your own ideas about how we can perform safe, sustainable anesthesia, please feel free to drop me a line at stylepointspodcast@gmail.com. And don't forget to share this with your friends. Take a deep breath. Open your eyes. We're all done.